This is March 27th, 2024. Debbie Goldman is conducting the interview with Hetty Rosenstein, who is in, where are you, Hetty?
I'm in South Orange, New Jersey.
In South Orange, New Jersey. This is via Zoom. Jeff Reckenbach is joining me and will also pose questions as and make comments as appropriate. He's in Cleveland. No, Cleveland? You live in Cleveland, right?
Cleveland.
Cleveland, Ohio. And Hannah Goldman, our producer, is in Brooklyn, New York. And Hetty, you may see some last name correspondence. Hannah is my delightful niece. And because of her, we are actually, Jeff and I don't have to fiddle with all of the technology. The goal here is to record the union experience and the lives and the values and the beliefs of a range of CWA leaders from over the past 50 years. And Jeff and I are particularly interested in understanding how union leaders responded to the enormous changes that were going on in this period and used and developed strategies, tactics, and relationships that strengthened and transformed the union, and also those areas in which there was less success. And we begin at the beginning. So, Hetty, tell us when you were born, where, and a little bit about your family background and your community.
I was born in 1955, and I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens until I was about 14 years old, and then my parents moved to Maplewood, New Jersey. My parents were political activists, and I grew up in a very left activist pro-union household.
Tell us the names of your parents.
Miriam and Phil. Miriam Yaffe and Phil Rosenstein, and they met at UCLA on the library steps where the left students hung out. And my father was there on the GI Bill, and my mother was a student, and that is where they met and fell in love.
Well, tell us then about what kind of household it was, given that they were activists, and how that shaped your own upbringing and values.
So I don't think that we understood it, that we were very different as children than everybody else, but we were. We went to, very left-wing summer camps, and we participated in boycotts, and my father went to Washington in 1963. We knew that. My mother worked for the Civil Rights Congress. My grandparents were activists and leftists. My father grew up in the Coops in New York, in the Bronx, which was socialist union-owned cooperative. I think it was the ILG at that time. And actually, the Coops, I think, originally were ILG. I'm not completely sure. They were definitely garment workers. Whether or not it was yet the ILG, I don't know. But yeah, so that was the household that I grew up in.
When you said your father went in 1963, that was to the March on Washington?
Yes, to the March on Washington. And we engaged in the civil rights movement our whole lives. And I was in camp when I was at this summer camp, Twin Link Camp, where we learned that TLC, Twin Link Camp, didn't stand for tender, loving care. You didn't go to Twin Link Camp to have fun. You went to learn responsibility to your community. I was six. But I remember when they found Goodman and Cheney and Schwerner, and at camp we were called together. I mean, so I grew up in this very intensely active world. And when I was 9 years old, we moved to a cooperative housing project in Queens called Rochdale Village.
Called
And
what?
Rochdale Village in
Can you
South
spell it?
Queens, Rochdale. There had been a Rochdale in Great Britain. And it was this very, at that time, sort of forward-looking, huge cooperative development. And our cousins moved there, and other families that we knew from politics. And so there was a core of very left families that we grew up with. So again, it took a while before I suddenly realized that this was not particularly the usual family, and the things we said weren't generally agreed with.
How many siblings do you have?
I have an older sister, Maida, who was the president of Local 2110 of the UAW and is the organizing director there now for 40 years. I have a brother, Jed, who lives now in France. And I have my sister, Stacia, who's 11 years younger than me. She was sort of the next generation of us. There were four of us.
And what work did your parents do? Paid work.
They were librarians. My father was a medical librarian. Eventually, my mother goes to library school while we are little kids. And she also becomes a medical librarian.
And why did you move to Maplewood, New Jersey?
My father got the job. He got this job for the University of Medicine and Dentistry as the head of libraries. And this is like a huge change in our lives because he kind of makes a living, right? He makes a lot more money. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't a lot of money, but it was a lot more money than being at Brooklyn College of Pharmacy. And so that was first, it was located in Jersey City, and then it moves to Newark. And so it was too much of a commute. He did commute for a couple of years. So there's this decision that we're going to move. We're going to move so that he can commute to Newark. And they find this house in Maplewood, New Jersey. And it's the first single family home I think I had ever really been in. I mean, my cousins had one, but they were sort of more of the little boxy types in Canarsie, so it was a little different, but a big single family home with a yard. And I thought they were moving me to Hooterville. I could not believe what they were doing to me, moving me to this place. And we they took us to see the house for the first time. It was in January, and in the downtown of Maplewood, there was like this Dickens Village, which were these cute little houses that were from Charles Dickens. And I saw this Dickens Village, and I could not believe that they were moving me to this place that had a Dickens Village. So anyway, so we moved to Maplewood.
And that's where you went to high school.
Went to high school, yeah.
And I think I heard then your grandparents, were they immigrants from Eastern Europe?
Oh, yeah.
All four sets?
Well, my grandfather was from Lithuania, on my mother's side. They were from Lithuania. On my father's side, they were from Zurmin, Poland, which was a town that essentially got entirely wiped out during the Holocaust, the whole town. I mean, they were here already, but when an April 30th, in I think 1940, the entire town was gathered, told to come out, and the entire town was eliminated eventually. So, yeah. Yeah, so that's where they were from.
Any stories or memories from your pre-college years, and I'm assuming you went to college, I'm not sure you did, that you would like to add? to these what you've said so far?
So, you know, I followed my sister, my older sister Maida, into the labor movement. She was organizing with District 65 at the time, clerical workers at NYU, and she was a clerical worker at NYU. But the thing that I remember most about my sister and her union-like activity is when she was in high school, she and a few other girls led what became a citywide pants strike because girls had to wear dresses. And they led a pants strike where all the girls in support of that strike wore pants to school. And it actually broke the rule that girls had to wear dresses.
I'm guessing late 60s. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I couldn't wear pants to school till 1968.
I was going to say, I think it's 1968. That was what I was going to say. I think it's 1968. And I think really that's that pants strike is the beginning of the end of the rule.
Okay. Jeff, do you want to ask anything about the period we've up till where we've come so far?
This is fascinating. I'm like blown away with this. This is really great. Thanks for doing this and sharing this with us, Eddie. Big deal to me.
It's nice to do.
Yeah. Let's get to the college.
Yep. Okay. Did you go to college? If so, where? And were you an activist? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. I mean, I went to college first at University of Massachusetts at Boston. And I was living in Boston in 1971 with my musician boyfriend, going to Boston State College, which was, you know, UMass's Boston State. And we took over the radio station in protest of there not being any girls' athletics and the what became the Title IX case. So I remember that. We took over the radio station.
What do you mean, what became the Title IX case? This was the lead case?
This was, well, it was a bunch of places where there ended up being plaintiffs from, and this was one of them, and it was part of that struggle. I was an early feminist, and that was the place where Our Bodies Ourselves was formed in Boston. So it's really early feminism, which is pretty militant, right? We, you know, took Taekwondo self-defense classes and, you know, did all this, you know, self looking at people's cervixes and all of this. And we, you know, there was all of this issue about kind of learning about, you know, there was a gay rights movement at the same time, and we would say, I'm a political lesbian. And so I was really active in that while I was there. And then I ended up moving back to New Jersey after a time and going to Rutgers, and certainly was active.
Were you in SDS or any feminist collectives?
Well, in Boston, I was.
Which one?
I don't know if I know what it was called. I know we had a center and I went to it, and I don't, beyond that, I can't really remember. And then when we moved back to New Jersey, I was definitely active and did things at college. I wasn't as much in an organization for a while. And I mean, I certainly was, you know, engaged politically, but I wasn't a part of an organization at that point. And when I left college, I got a job at a pension consulting firm. I wanted to be a teacher, but believe it or not, there were no teaching jobs then. It was really hard to get a teaching job. And of course, I was going to be a teacher for social studies, which nobody, you know, there were a million of them. But anyway, so I went to work for this pension consulting firm and I became an assistant actuary. And that's only interesting because years later, I still use it when we have pension fights. And then after becoming in a, doing that, I found, I wanted to go back to teaching and I found a job at the New Jersey Job Corps, which was a job corps that was run by the state of New Jersey. And the working conditions were just horrendous. And there was nothing for the students. I mean, we didn't have materials. The conditions were terrible. And so a group of teachers actually organized there because we needed to organize in order to be able to do our jobs. It was really connected to what work we would do. And we had no idea that the state of New Jersey had a union, the State Employees Association, because nobody paid attention to anybody at Job Corps. And there wasn't any agency shop then. So you just didn't even know. We had no idea. And so we filed our own petition to management that said, we, the undersigned teachers, are now part of the New Jersey Job Corps Union. And I did it because my sister was organizing. So I knew we needed a union. So we gave them that. And then I went figuring out, how are we going to find a union? And then they came back to us, management came back to us and said, there is a union. It's the State Employees Association. And so then when we tried to track down the State Employees Association, we found out that they were being decertified and there was an election taking place between the AFT, CWA, and AFSCME.
What year is this?
That's 1980 and 1981.
And this was soon after.
80 is the first one, and then I think 81 is the runoff.
And this is soon after or before New Jersey passes the collective bargaining law for state employees?
It's after. I think the New Jersey collective bargaining law is 1968 or 69. It's very early. The New Jersey collective bargaining law. Because it's the New Jersey collective bargaining law connects up actually with the initial organizing of public workers that you know takes place with AFSCME and Martin Luther King and Frank Forst, who is the father of Fran Arrett, who's the New Jersey area director now. He is the person who does the work to get the New Jersey collective bargaining law passed. So it's later.
Okay.
And the State Employees Association had been a civil service association. And when the New Jersey collective bargaining law takes place, the Civil Service Association morphs into a collective bargaining agent. And this is getting rid of the Civil Service Association and the State Employees Association and coming in with the union, basically after a 1979 failed Wildcat strike.
Okay, we won't go back to that, but offline I want to talk to you about that because I thought it was much later. But so now we're around 1980, 81, and you said there's an election going on between the State Employees Association, AFSCME, and CWA, which is where Larry Cohn comes in, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
The State Employee Association affiliates with the AFT, and AFSCME is already represents the non-professional workers in institutions, and then CWA comes in, and Larry Cohen is the organizer for this state worker organizing committee, SWOC, SWOC, which is, I don't think we knew, but he certainly deliberately chose the same thing as what was the Steelworkers Organizing Committee at one point, right? Okay, so I am at the state I am at New Jersey Job Corps, and we learn about this, and I call and try to find people to come down and talk to us about what's happening in terms of this election. And I call really just as the election is happening, and I don't think we even get ballots in at Job Corps. I think we're trying to find out what's going on, and CWA wins the clerical unit. And there's a runoff between AFSCME and CWA and the other three units. And we are in the professional unit at the Job Corps. And that's really the point where I become most active, is before that runoff.
Okay, keep going with the story.
So I don't remember. I think that... So I get all of our people to support CWA. In fact, I know what happens. I go to see these friends, a friend of mine whose parents were really active, and I didn't know CWA, and I wasn't sure about AFSCME. And so I went to see these friends who were, you know, of my parents who were still very active. And my friend's father said, oh, go with CWA, because that's an industrial union and that's CIO. Go with CWA. And that's why I have my whole, everybody go to CW, end up voting for CWA. And
can we send them a thank you note?
Yeah. I mean, this is, there's so much to this. Anyway, so I'm getting really active in the union, and they're forming locals. I don't even remember.
Now CWA has won the runoff for the professional unit.
I think they may even form the locals before the runoff. I can't remember now. But yes, CWA wins the runoff and takes all four bargaining units. And it's a 40,000 person unit. It's the largest organizing drive since probably the 50s in this country. I mean, it was a huge victory and an unbelievable thing that happens in New Jersey. It's a moment in time for the labor movement itself in New Jersey, and changes, I think, completely changes the labor movement in New Jersey. Which at that point, prior to CWA, is basically auto workers, garment workers, right? So there are still industrial and manufacturing in New Jersey, which is going to disappear. And there's building trades. And in New Jersey, you never really get a merger of the AFL-CIO. There's the in CIO unions, and there's the AFL unions, and it's very, very different. But anyway, so
eventually, is CWA in both?
Well, eventually, the AFL-CIO basically crushes the Industrial Union Council, right? And it kind of becomes a fringe group. You know, I mean, it's good. Like Carol Gay is still the president of the IUC here. But at one point, the IUC was really, we sort of really breathed life into the IUC, and it was a going concern. And we had auto workers, and we had machinists and garment workers, and, you know, but that disappears. And so it changes. And the progressive part of the labor movement becomes really CWA and some other unions, but it's CWA. It becomes the progressive part of the labor movement in New Jersey.
So now CWA has, you said, four units. I heard clerical, professional.
Primary level supervisory and a secondary supervisory unit. So we've got everything but paraprofessionals that AFSCME has, and some trade and craft that IFPTE has.
And how does CWA form the state worker locals? What's the logic and your role in that?
Well, it's probably pretty mixed. To some extent, I think those locals get formed around what's leadership is there. There are a couple of statewide locals, which are the institutions, which is Local 1040, Local 1032, which is the Department of Transportation, which just covers the whole state, and Local 1031, which is higher education. It's the non-faculty clerical and professionals in higher education at the state colleges. And then in the downtown Trenton areas, there are locals formed covering several departments because there's huge numbers in these departments in downtown Trenton. And then there are two field locals, one in the north and one in the south. 1037 is in the north and 1038 is in the south. And I'm in 1037. 1037 is a field local of offices, people in field offices from Ocean County up through Sussex. So that's the whole northern part of the state. And Local 1038 is from below Trenton down to the Cape May, which is the whole southern part. So we're kind of mirror images of each other as locals. And I'm in Local 1037. I'm basically taken off the job initially to do organizing. Internal organizing. We have very, very few members. And in these field locals, we probably have the lowest membership of all because most of the attention has been focused in Trenton and to some extent in Essex County, New Jersey, so up north, but not in the field locals. And so my initial job is to get people signed up for the union. And I feel like I'm born to it. It's like, I feel like, I don't know, I have the organizing gene. I didn't know it, but I'm born to it. And we set up this program and we are really successful. We get people to join the union. We establish shop stewards. We create this really robust shop steward program.
What is the organizing gene?
I do think it's related to being a librarian. I don't know. I don't know. I say the organizing gene because some people, I'm not saying you can't learn organizing, because you can't. But there are some people who just think like organizers.
And what is it? Is it thinking about tracking and keeping records? Is it about liking people? Is it?
Yeah, I think it's about figuring, I think, well, first of all, for me, it's very visual. So it's like, where are all the places of power and where people are? And then it is identifying leadership that people will follow in those places and working with them. And it's being able to know what letting people figure out themselves what are the issues that they care about and that they'll organize around and what is meaningful to them, and then being organized, really being organized. So the tracking part I think is critical, but it's not how it starts. I think it starts with a vision of what's out there and who are the people and what's the power and how do you recruit and find leadership from those groups and then have them be those leaders. So I really came from this shop steward model and the idea of trade union education and that's how I saw the union organizing work. I was always all about the shop stewards. And so that was one part. And then there was a second part, which I think was really critically important for Local 1037, and I think for the state worker locals, which is, and Larry articulated it, which was that we were not only organizing for ourselves and doing this work for ourselves, we were going to represent the services that we provided as public workers and the people who relied upon those services. And so that we saw our work as deeply ingrained in, you know, the organizing of the working class, I think, and in, you know, what are the public goods, right? That the public sector represents the public good. And so it was a very different model, and I think vision of the union, frankly, than what CWA had before. It was, you know, we were definitely the odd ducks in that way, not to mention the fact that, you know, we weren't all white men. And that was very clear. You know, when there were these conventions, you know, these earliest conventions that I went to, and they were huge, and they would take these, they had this camera that would go on this, do a whole huge scan of the entire convention, and we could always tell where New Jersey was, because it wasn't all white and it wasn't all male. You could see it from there. Oh, there we are, right there. So we were different.
Can you give an example when you talk about marrying the worker issues with the public good?
Yeah, we did it early on. I mean, very early on, we engaged. So I think, unlike anybody, I don't think any unions ever did this, right? We knew there was not enough money to provide good public services for people. And so we created and formed New Jersey Citizen Action with other allies, with Larry Cohen as the founding coach, the founding chair. And we took on the issue of progressive taxation with a Republican governor, and we passed a progressive income tax. And so we did that. I mean, we knew it was related to our jobs, but it was also just related to what kinds of public services will we have, what will New Jersey have, and this, you know, and what we thought about progressive income taxes. We were the only place that had a legislative political director. We didn't have a title for it in New Jersey, so it became a staff rep. It was Steve Rosenthal.
Oh.
And we were the only place in the country that had a legislative political coordinator, and we focused our work around the broad range of social justice issues that there were. And the other part was that because we were public sector, we didn't have a legal right to strike. I mean, we did strike, by the way, people forget that. We did have strikes. We did have walkouts. But we didn't have a legal right to strike. And so we had to figure out other ways to express power. And in CWA, you know, it wasn't even divestiture then, right? So CWA conducted nationwide strikes, right? And was a militant union, but it relied upon the strike, right? That was the method. Well, we didn't have the strike, and we had to figure out how to be powerful in the state without it. And I think to this day, there are people who don't really understand how strong we have been and how we do exercise tremendous power without the right to strike. And we figured out other ways to do it, whether or not we were very politically active. We did mobilization. We created this thing called the Committee of 1,000.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so we were in contract negotiations, and there were very different levels of organization in different locals, numbers of shop stewards. People just had different degrees of capacity at that time. And so we created this Committee of 1,000. I'll have to come up. I think it's 1986 at that point. And we had 1,000 members of the Committee of 1,000 who were going to mobilize the rest of the workforce. And we, we started mobilization, which was one person who was responsible for 10 or 20 others that we would start with buttons, move to petitions, do demonstrations, everybody stand up, everybody sit down, everybody blow a whistle, everybody walk out. All of the things that ultimately become the CWA model for mobilization, they start in New Jersey.
And how does
But
that show power?
well, there's tremendous engagement from workers. We do a lot of work to connect with other unions who at that point have, nobody's been doing anything like this in New Jersey, right? So we are getting involved with other unions. We are developing these relationships with other groups and creating these coalitions and having our members directly engage in direct action. So there's in New Jersey, there's a people fall under civil service, and the civil service can change a rule by just publishing a new rule in the New Jersey Register and by holding a public hearing. And they would do that all the time, except what we did was we went to the public hearing and we would turn out 900 people to some public hearing in Essex, at a church, because they would hold them in a few places. And we would turn out hundreds and hundreds of people and make the connections between civil service and civil rights and civil service and good government when they had kind of long been lost. Oh, I should say this is one of the things that we did that I think was incredible. In probably around 1983, maybe, Tom Kaine is the governor. We put together a campaign to divest New Jersey pension funds from South Africa. And we are the first, and we convinced Tom Kaine, a Republican, to do it. And we run a whole campaign with allied groups, and we are the first state public pension in the country to divest from South Africa. And years later, I'm at a concert where Hugh Masekela, for the first time, is in New Jersey performing, and he comes out and he says, "Hello, New Jersey. You were the first people to divest pension funds from South Africa. So I want to say thank you to you." It was really incredible. So, I mean, we did amazing things. And
Let's stop for a minute around that specific one.
yeah.
And you talked about diversity. So talk about where did the commitment to participate in the freedom for the end of apartheid in South Africa come from? And what role did that play in terms of the union and representing the voice of what I believe in your units was a significant African American membership.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. As there were certainly many, many more Black and Brown people in the New Jersey public sector than any place else in the,
Than any place else in the union, you're saying.
union. Yeah, because we had civil service, right? Because you could get a job. Because we had civil service, so they couldn't deny you a job. And we have a whole story about what we did in terms of LGBT rights, because in 19, either 83 or 86, those contracts we negotiated into our contract, that there could not be any discrimination against people based upon gender preference in our CWA contracts in 83 or 86. It's pretty incredible. And domestic partnership in 1996, I think, or 1999. So really early. So, I mean, I think part of it is that, look, at the core, we have Larry. So we have this really extraordinary leadership. You know, it's leadership, and it's leadership that's unusual in the union, right? So we have Larry Cohen leading the organizing drive in that direction from its start. And we have pretty sophisticated political people who are part of the union early on, because we have Steve Rosenthal as our political director, you know, the guy who becomes the political director for the AFL-CIO, right? And becomes a deputy under Robert Reich. So that's our political director.
Was Eileen Curlin in New Jersey?
Eileen Curlin is part of the original organizing drive, and she's one of the staff representatives. So, you know, I mean, Alan Kaufman is a staff representative. He was a freedom rider. Alan Kaufman was one of two freedom riders in Mississippi, and he's a CWA staff rep. So it's pretty, you know, it's pretty extraordinary, kind of this mix that comes together there in New Jersey. And it's also, you know, a point in time that, you know, you get Reagan and the air traffic controllers, and right, it's a time of real destruction. And, you know, Larry sent us all, we all went, we brought local members to picket at airports for the air traffic controllers. I mean, we had a sense of, we knew what was going on. So yeah, it was a pretty extraordinary, not just an extraordinary time, but the union develops in a certain way in New Jersey.
I want to add, when you mentioned citizen action, am I correct that you became the chair?
I became the chair of National Citizen Action at a certain point. I became the chair of New Jersey Working Families. We founded New Jersey Working Families here. I mean, I'm still active in New Jersey Citizen Action and New Jersey Working Families still. And CWA is still critically important to those organizations.
How would you say... let's go back to organizing. Were you involved then in organizing the state and local units of CWA?
Somewhat. I see that my battery is going down, so I'm going to run upstairs, if you don't mind, and get my cord and plug it. Is that okay?
That's
Debbie,
great.
You can go check on your plumber.
I will.
Be right back.
There's so much that you mentioned and I jotted down that I want to follow up on. And I try not to go down too many rabbit holes because we do want to move it forward. But I think quickly just talk a little bit about CWA then expanded, if I understand correctly, to represent the county employees and the local employees. So eventually...
CWA represented the county welfare boards before the state workers.
Okay.
And those locals kind of felt out in space, but we had welfare boards, the social service boards before the state workers, and local 1085, which was the Gloucester County group, is the place that Larry Cohen first goes to do organizing. He's really there at local 1085. So the local government groups were there already. And then the state worker group comes in. And then we do a lot of organizing after that, right? We expand a lot in New Jersey. We represent, you know, we organize a lot of private nonprofits. We organize a bunch of municipalities. We affiliate a lot of old civil service groups, right? So Camden County, Local 14, they are now CWA, you know, 1014, and there's a bunch of them like that. There's a huge, robust public sector. We also, at the same time, though, have telecom, but telecom is shrinking. And in New Jersey, the plant telecommunications is not CWA, it's IBEW. And it's operator services that is CWA. So, of course, operator services has shrunk down to nothing.
And you have service reps.
Service reps too, yes. But I mean, we had 411 operators, right? Like huge numbers of 411 operators. There's none, you know. When I started, you had huge locals, you know, local 1022 and 1023 were enormous, and local 1010 and 1012, those were big locals. They've all combined to be local 1000. And it's not that large a local.
And you also at one point had AT&T.
We had AT&T.
And Bell Labs.
Bell Labs, right. And so telecom shrunk enormously in New Jersey. And the public sector has remained pretty stable and in some cases expanded. So New Jersey is, that New Jersey again is very different from the rest of the district.
And so talk about how you impacted and were impacted by being in District 1.
That's a good question. There were a couple of parts to that. At the time that New Jersey organized, probably any place else that had brought in that many people would have probably become a district. But Morty Barr was the vice president of District 1. Larry was working for District 1. And the plan was we're going to make District 1 bigger. And so, I mean, when Pennsylvania came in, when 1300 came into CWA, 13,000 came into CWA, which is after this, that becomes a district.
That was part of their merger agreement.
Right. And that was maybe a third of the size of New Jersey. So New Jersey comes into District 1, was in District 1, but stays in District 1 with this additional 40,000 people. And it makes District 1 a behemoth. So in many ways, District 1 had already been the power, right, house. But having that many more people come into the district makes District 1 a behemoth. And so that's an interesting fact, I think, about District 1 and the overall politics of New Jersey, of the union, that has positives and negatives. So how does it affect us? Well, you know, Morty Barr goes on to become the president of the union. So we have this direct relationship with the president of the union, certainly. Larry goes on to be the organizing director.
That's about, I'm trying to remember, when did he leave New Jersey? Around midnight. Morty became president, I think, in 85.
Well, Larry goes with him.
Yeah, so around 86. So it wasn't long after you all organized
this. I think we bargained the 1986 contract forward in 86. I think Larry is still here when we bargain the 1986 contract. But he leaves and he goes and then Jan Pierce is the vice president of District 1. So we now have a pretty, a very progressive activist vice president at that point. But what I will say is that New Jersey, this is a positive, I think, overall. We kind of are ignored a bit, you know, by District 1. We're not important to District 1. District 1 only thinks mostly about telecom. And so we are left very nicely in certain ways to not have to be in that. There's a whole very negative period in New Jersey where there's locals fighting, is lots of development of that, which, but I do think a lot of things that develop in New Jersey are able to develop because they aren't part of that culture. They are a different culture. The way we did politics, being really ingrained inside coalition forces, you know, and seeing ourselves as part of this broader progressive coalition, I think made a big difference for us.
So what I'm hearing from you is there wasn't a significant cultural impact of bringing in a more diverse workforce, of bringing in the mobilization mentality or tactic or strategy. That didn't fertilize the telecom locals in New York?
Well, so there's a couple reasons why I would say yes and otherwise no. Remember, in 1989, you have this huge telecom strike.
Right.
This enormous 9X strike. So this is a very powerful militant moment in the union, and certainly is massive mobilization. And I don't think that it's New Jersey that influences that. I think this is, you know, this is the union's culture, and it's in many ways, it's at its finest moment, right? And but it doesn't mean that we don't really mesh mm-hmm. in that sense. But you do have this extraordinary moment, and you do have this very militant vice president. And I will say that I think Joanne Pierce was very supportive of the work we did in New Jersey, very supportive of it. And in New Jersey at the same time, you know, you have Christy Whitman taking over. We get this Republican and this direct attack on our rights and our benefits. And so we go through a really very, very difficult time period, and a very, very rough contract where we take a beating.
Which year was that?
That's in 1996 or 1995. We take a beating and it's rough.
Beating in terms of privatization, in terms of the pension?
All of it. Privatization, concessions, dismantling of a lot of our healthcare. I mean, now what happened seems nothing compared to what ends up happening eventually. But it, you know, it's, we take, there's layoffs. There's a lot of layoffs. There's cuts in federal funding, right? Because this is a Reagan era. There's cuts in federal funding that result in many, many layoffs. There's closures of institutions. There's privatization of motor vehicles. It's a very, very hard number of years for us that we fight. We fight hard.
Do you want to give some examples of the fights?
Oh, motor vehicles. We nearly take Christy Whitman down with motor vehicles. They go to privatize the motor vehicle agencies, which they successfully do. But we walk out three different times and shut them down. We create a massive political problem for her because we expose that these motor vehicle agencies are being given out for political, you know, to people politically. So you can have your own motor vehicle agency because you're a Republican and here it is. And we expose it. I mean, it is a brutal fight and it's taking place in the middle of a contract. And they're attacking our healthcare at the same time. We lose our healthcare indemnity plan, you know, and we do ultimately lose the motor vehicle privatization fight. I mean, it happens that one night, you know, we're almost there. We almost win it. It falls apart and motor vehicles is shut down and given away. And we continue to work with motor vehicle workers. We follow them and we try to organize them, but we have a whole relationship with them. And so the next governor's race, when Jim McGreevy is running against Christy Whitman, he almost beats her that time. He doesn't, but we, you know, get a commitment from him. We're going to get motor vehicles back. And the very first thing he does when he comes into office is he brings back motor vehicles. So that was a long time, pretty amazing fight. But anyway.
That's a great story. Tell another one. I mean, that's a story of sticking with the workers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was an incredible, incredible victory and an amazing thing to do. And so, I mean, I think that there are a lot of things to talk about. There's, you know, chapter 78 when Steve Sweeney comes in and dismantles our healthcare collective bargaining rights and they stop funding our pension for 25 years. And, you know,
the ideological background to that one is very interesting. Steve Sweeney was a building trades guy, right?
He's an iron worker.
And talk about that tension then between unionized private sector and public sector and how you maneuvered that.
Well, I think that for many, many years, powerful forces in the Democratic Party, but particularly Sweeney, use the difference between the building trades and the public sector. And they basically, you know, the building trades are real union people. They're men and they do real work. And us public sector people are girls and we're not white. And we don't, you know, we work in offices. And so Steve Sweeney, who is the big labor candidate, is going on the attack initially against John Corzine. And he doesn't want to pay our pension. And he comes out with Save Our State with a long list. And it's Democrats who come out with this long list of everything that, you know, dismantling our contracts, taking away our holidays, making 35-hour workers, 40-hour workers without any additional pay, you know, taking our health care away, not giving, putting us in a 401k. This is this huge list. And so that fight goes on with him for many years. And when Chris Christie comes in, he's successful. He makes a deal with Chris Christie and six Democratic senators and a handful of Democratic members of the Assembly and all of the Republicans vote to pass Chapter 78, which dismantles our healthcare collective bargaining rights and imposes very, very large costs on our members for healthcare, cuts our pensions by huge amounts, the value of the pension by huge amounts, which they still then don't fund, and make cause us to pay more for it. And it's brutal. It's a brutal, huge fight. And CWA and other public sector unions, we hold a Well, we hold a demonstration in May on a Saturday where we must have had 40,000 people.
May of what year?
I think it's 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2011, they actually passed the Chapter 78, and we have tons of people. We have tons of people who walk out and end up in the streets in Trenton outside of the State House in the pouring rain. And the New Jersey and the Democrats that aren't supporting Sweeney walk out with us. They walk out of the State House for the vote. And 16 state senators, and I don't remember how many members of the assembly, but it's probably like 35 or 40. And they walk out with us. And all of this is taking place sort of during at the same time as Wisconsin. So we have these signs that say Sweeney plus walk, Sweeney plus Christie equals Walker, which he hung up in his office. He was proud of that song. He's running for governor, by the way. So we've had a, I don't know, 20-year fight with Steve Sweeney.
Is it fair to also add to that, that he played on the anger and anxiety of private sector workers who were losing wages, who didn't have pensions, who didn't have health care? In other words, the decline in working class living standards, and portrayed it as, oh, those public workers have those things and you don't.
Oh, and they're taking them from you. The reason there isn't enough money and we're not building is because all the money goes to them. They have all the money, which, I mean, yes, it's public and private. It's sexist and racist too. They have it. You don't have it. They are getting things you don't have. And I mean, look, they did outrageous things. They had the, they had the new, I'm losing words, you know. I want to say the interns. It's not the interns. It's the folks coming into the trades, right? They have them come to hearings and events against us.
The apprentices.
Against us. It's really quite remarkable.
So did this mean that... did you have a political education program to redirect the focus on corporate America is who we should be fighting?
Thanks for prompting me, because we did. And we did all the train the trainer work early on. I can remember doing train the trainer work, which maybe, I don't remember if the original stuff was designed by Les Leopold. It's really early on. And, you know, we did work with shop stewards and watching people's, like, the scales come from their eyes when they realize what is taking place in terms of corporate power. And at that, you know, that point, you don't have anything near the runaway inequality, but Wall Street, you know, the role of Wall Street, the role of money in politics. By the way, in New Jersey, we, before Citizens United, we passed a public funding, political funding. It was a pilot project, and we ran Linda Greenstein, who's still there, and two others, now I can't remember who, under public funding. And we had to get a certain number of campaign contributions of $5 or more in order to qualify. And we basically did it with our members. We went out and we said, we need this. So we have to raise this money in Trenton and in that district, and raised $5 contributions to have them be eligible for public funding. And then Citizens United came and it was gone.
Linda Greenstein, I don't know that name. What
She's
did she
a
run?
State senator now. She's still a state senator. And, you know, I mean, there were a group of them that were very much supporters of ours. We had some really great legislators at that time. Well, we had Alan Karcher at one point as the assembly speaker. I mean, it was really quite remarkable, some of this work.
Your leadership and your units were definitely known for your focus on steward training. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I still think it is the most important thing that the union can do. And I felt very strongly that every part of our work was going to run through shop stewards, that shop stewards were going to be the worksite leaders, and our political work, our representation work, regulatory work, mobilization, every single thing, health and safety work at Local 1037, all of that work would run through shop stewards. That's not generally the point of view of the union. I mean, and that's not the CWA model. And it's not the CWA model in New Jersey now. I mean, we have these LPATs and we have health and safety committees and we have those things separate. That was actually not my point of view, but whatever. And I continue to think that shop steward education is the thing that is most important and what we must invest in. And we did. We invested a huge amount of money in shop steward training, in taking shop stewards off the job, in projecting shop stewards as leaders, and in trying to give them as much support as possible in doing that work on the job. And I still think it's critically important, and I don't know any other way to do it. It still seems to me to be the most important work that the labor movement can do.
And why?
Because you can't possibly, first of all, you can't possibly hire enough staff to, you know, we did it out of necessity at Local 1037. We had 450 different field work sites representing 10,000 people. There was no way you could do it if you didn't do it with shop stewards. So, but that's true for the labor movement as a whole. You can't represent all these workers and you can't have engaged workers unless you have people on the job who are doing it. So I think, so that, you know, part of it is really out of necessity. But the other part is that it is too hard for people to know what is going on for themselves as a working class, as a state worker, as a telecom worker, as a bus driver. There's no way in your own life that you can know all that is going on for the people that are like you. Unless you get some specific time and opportunity to learn all of that and then be able to tell other people about it, because we're all siloed, we're all so separated. It's even so much worse now because we do it on Zoom. We don't even do it with each other. We're separated by whether or not we're this kind of worker versus that kind of worker, whether we live in this area or that area. Everything's on our phone. There's so little community that I kind of feel like the only way you create that is if you have leadership trying to create it. So when I became the area director in New Jersey, and
which
and
was in, I'm looking at your timeline, 2008.
Yeah, 2008.
And I'm going to interject here from the timeline you sent me. You were secretary of the local at some point in the 1980s, became the EVP a few years later, remained the EVP for quite a few terms, became the president of Local 1037 in 2002, hired by the National Union in 2008 as New Jersey Area Director and District 1 Organizing Director. Now we've got that on tape. Now keep going with your story.
Yeah. I met my husband and married him from the union also.
And his name?
Mike Hopkins. He was the president of Local 1037.
And Hetty, do you have children?
I have one. my son James, we have one, and he is a senior organizer with ATU.
Okay, now I've interrupted your train of thought. I hope you can get back to it.
Well, you've been really helpful, because I don't think I would have remembered any of these things. Okay, so when I became the area director, and this was controversial, and it's not followed now. I mean, I think it worked. So I am disappointed at it. But I worked out with Chris Shelton directly, and with the support of Larry Cohen, that we were going to try to unsilo New Jersey. And that we would have one area director instead of two. And that I would also direct the organizing that was going on in New Jersey, and really that we would integrate all of our work. And we did. So organizers met with internal organizers, with staff representatives, with the legislative political director. And in terms of the work that we did, we integrated it. So if you were bargaining a contract, you got political support, mobilization and organizing support, and we were trying to put all of those pieces together instead of having telecom here, you know, public sector here, private nonprofits, local government. We really worked hard to try to integrate it. And I think successfully. I mean, it's always a struggle. I don't want to suggest that it was perfect or that, but I think it was a good thing to do. And it gave us a great deal more power. And that we, in those years, we really developed with the kind of stature as a union, as being considered one of the most powerful unions in the state. And the leadership, again, of the progressive forces. I mean, we had that with Larry, but there's a real dip off, and I think we do it again. And we fight very, very hard over pension, and we had before, but it's the meaning of my existence. And it's the first thing that Phil Murphy does when he comes in, is he makes a full pension payment. First, you know, we have had the first full pension payments in 25 years, and he's made four of them.
How did you mobilize for that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, tell the story. That'll make concrete what you're talking about.
I mean, every single budget, every time we fought, there have been so many times where we were calling for pension funding and fighting for pension funding and struggling to save the pension. And it was always used against us. If we wanted pension funding, they basically would say, well, we have to cut your pension so that there's money to fund your pension. And then they would cut the pension and they still didn't make the payments. It went on for years and years, but everybody knew it and understood it. And so getting it to the point where it was in the ether that the pension was going to go under and that we, you know, we had to get funding. And Corzine tried. I mean, he was starting to make, at that point, a full pension funding, payment would be $1 billion. And he made a big deal by making a 70%, $700 million payment into the pension fund. And Sweeney had a huge fit, didn't want it. He was doing a penny tax because that was going to go to us, and see, they're raising the sales tax to pay their pension. And then 2008, the floor went out on, you know, the economy tanked and there wasn't money to make a pension payment. And then when Christie comes in, you know, there's once again a huge, big attack on the pension. But because they never made pension payments, a full pension payment now is $7 to $8 billion out of the New Jersey budget to make. There was a point in time where that pension payment was $350 million and they wouldn't make it. It's $8 billion now. So,
am I remembering that you levied a special fee or raised dues or something to fund a fight around the pension?
We did. We were, this was a, you know, the Steve Sweeney bait and switch. Sweeney came to us before we knew he wanted to run for governor, but he comes to all of the unions and he says, let's do a constitutional amendment that they have to pay the pension. And we have many conversations and he's public in many, many ways that we're going to actually do a constitutional amendment, which we have to put on the ballot to pass a constitutional amendment that they have to make the payments. And this was done after we had sued because they don't make the payments and the judge says they don't have to make the payments under the law. The Supreme Court of New Jersey says this. So we decide we're going to put this on the ballot, but if we're going to put it on the ballot, it's going to be unbelievably costly to run this campaign. And New Jersey is a very, very expensive state because we only have New York and Philly media. And so we pass a dues increase. We get an agreement from the National Union that the National Union is going to basically lend us the money to run the campaign. And we're going to do it with NJEA, and we're hoping other unions as well. But
NJEA is who?
New Jersey Education Association. We're going to do it with them.
And Jeff, were you Secretary Treasurer at this point?
No, this is when I'm the area director.
No, oh, I was Jeff, asking
no,
Jeff.
Jeff.
No.
No.
No, I was already gone by then.
And so we pass a dues increase with our members. And the dues increase is subject to us, running this constitutional amendment. That's what we say. We tell people that.
So you had to convince the members it was worth it.
Yeah. And we do. And it's we get an overwhelming vote for it. We do a membership vote to pass a dues increase that will be used to pay off what we are going to borrow from the union's funds as a whole. And we pass it, and we are preparing for the constitutional amendment. And at the last minute, Sweeney pulls, he's the Senate president, and he pulls it and says, we're not going to have a constitutional amendment. And so we end the dues increase. We're out in Neverland again, and we wait until we elect Phil Murphy to be able to get pensions paid. And I'll tell you, I mean, we need to worry because, New Jersey has had a Democratic governor now for two terms. That was the first time in many, many years we had a Democratic governor for two full terms. The likelihood of, it will be difficult to elect another Democrat, and we will have a problem again with getting the pension funded.
What level is it funded at now?
About 44%.
Wow.
And this is the first year in a long time where it's been even. Enough money and has come in as has come out. It's the mm-hmm. first year in a long time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if we can keep it funded for another 10 or 15 years, we'll be all right. But that's a struggle. Mm-hmm.
How did you promote leadership, women and people of color, activism and leadership. Did you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when I was at 1037, I mean, we had a staff that was going to reflect the membership. We had women and people of color, LGBT folks in on staff and as officers, and that was a priority. Our shop stewards were reflective of the membership, and it was a priority, and we took it right on. You know, we were very conscious of it. And when I became the area director, New Jersey was in the district, the place where there were staff that was not, you know, overwhelmingly white men. Was still, there were still, it was still more, but in New Jersey, we had Black staff reps. And when I became the area director, and to this day, I mean, this has continued certainly with Fran Arrett. I mean, I pressed very hard for when we had vacancies for staff to be reflective and for it to be a diverse group. And for District 1, we were the place that had a really diverse staff. So I think you have, look, you have to care about it. You know, you have to decide this is what you're going to do. And you have to recognize even in yourself, and I think leadership has to recognize in itself the tendency to, you know, have its own internal bias and select people who are like them and they feel more comfortable with or they think are better at things. You have to decide that, you know, these positions are going to be reflective of the membership. And then, of course, when that happens, you realize the tremendous amount that you gain as an organization and that what people who are not exactly like you bring that you didn't have. So, I mean, I think that was critical. And of course, it wasn't just 1037. We had, you know, presidents of large state worker locals and local government locals. I mean, in New Jersey, because the state worker locals were so large, we always would think of the other locals as small, but they weren't small for CWA. I mean, we had a local government local of 600-700. That's not a small local in CWA. So, but the state worker locals were so big, we would think of the small locals. They were not small locals. And a lot of leadership, women, Black people. We had, you know, Carolyn Wade and now, you know, Michelle Vickers. I mean, president of a huge local, an incredibly powerful, respected Black woman. You know, we had that throughout New Jersey.
What local is she president of, Michelle?
She was president of Local 1040. She's gone now.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, now still lots of, I mean, the staff in New Jersey after I left, but, well, not all of them after I left, but George Jackson, who was the president of Local 1084 in Camden, is now a national staff rep, Black man. Leroy Baylor, who was the president of Local 1079, you know, now a national staff rep. Kim Johnson was the president of Local 1088 in Ocean County. She's a national staff rep. I go on and on. All people of color coming out of the bargaining unit. The legislative political coordinator for New Jersey is Chris Estevez. So we have a Latino man who was deeply engaged politically for years. Fran Arrett, who took my place, is a Latina lesbian. So it is a place of real, and that's the staff. And obviously locals are, you know, locals are different. Some are stronger than others, but Mickey Santiago, who's the president of Local 1032, Latino Muslim woman. New Jersey is really an extraordinary place in this way, and, you know, is something, you know, to be very, very proud of in the union.
You wrote to me the following. The New Jersey program ended up driving the union's entire agenda up through Larry Cohn's time as the union president. Could you elaborate on that statement?
Yeah, I mean, when Larry Cohn becomes the president, he tries to take this vision that we had in New Jersey, whether or not it was the shop steward's army and the million worker, I'm forgetting it. You know the booklet, Debbie, right?
Right.
That whole point of view, that comes out of New Jersey, which was, you know, having a shop steward's army and having the shop stewards drive program and militancy, recognizing that we can't make a majority by ourselves, but that if we are going to have millions of workers engage, it has to be us. It's got to be civil rights organizations. It's got to be environmental groups, faith groups. That vision of what we tried to do in New Jersey, he expanded and spoke for the entire union. So I do think that. I mean, he led it here, but he also saw it happen and I think brought it there. So
do you think being a public sector local and having members who were doing public service work was part of the shaping of it? Was part of it that you and Larry, and you mentioned Alan Kaufman, and I'm sure Carol Gay, and I'm sure there are other names you would add, and I hope you do, came out of a particular political movement that also helped shape the New Jersey experience?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, I think all of those people at one time were anti-war activists, and, you know, were politically engaged, you know, people believed strenuously in civil rights and in government for the public good. I also think that even if you didn't have quite that political point of view, if in those days, if you worked for a county welfare board, you went to work for a county welfare board because you wanted to do that work. The public sector was incredibly underpaid. You know, I became a teacher because I wanted to teach. I went to the Job Corps because I wanted to teach those kids that. So, you know, we went into that work because we had a vision of government and public service as part of what could change the world. And, you know, Larry was really, he knew and said, we do everything. You know, we're in every single place, whether it's social services, engineering, transportation, healthcare, we were everywhere. And so we did. You know, I do think that there was a lot of it. I mean, Carolyn Wade was a social worker before she was president of the local. The first president of Local 1032 was an engineer at the New Jersey Turnpike. Mike Hopkins, my husband, worked in employment services at the Department of Labor. So we really had a point of view. And by the way, I mean, all of these locals, like my local, ended up representing private sector workers also. But what did we think about that? We went and we organized private nonprofits that were doing group homework, home care, health care, and things of that nature. And we even, I think, looked at telecommunications in this way when we said speed matters and that everybody has to have access to internet. Everybody has to have, you know, we need equal access because it has something to do with how you can live in this world. We always took this point of view about our work. And I think it made us a really incredible union.
Any disappointments you want to mention?
I mean, I have some, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to criticize anybody. I mean, I don't, because it's really rough. I was really pained by the, you know, after I left, I was really pained over the election for president of the union. That was painful, very, very painful to me. I thought, I mean, I think not the end result, but, you know, the sausage making that was taking place. And, you know, I was disappointed in people supporting the person lost. So that's the truth. I don't know if that belongs here, but.
Yeah, Hetty, you'll have the option to nix that statement if you'd like.
It's your call. I mean,
I think in general, whatever you want, but certainly you'll have a chance to do that. Are there any other individuals that we haven't talked about that we're really, you want to acknowledge and mention?
I mean, Chris Shelton did something that was really not heard of. He made me an area director, and I was, you know, I mean, I wasn't like on team national, whatever. I was a militant. He made me an area director. And at that point, there were three women area directors in New Jersey. I mean, in District 1. That wasn't any place else. He did that. And he was so supportive of me. You know, if I said, I want to try this, this is different, let's try this, he would say, go to it. And he was so supportive of the work that we were doing in New Jersey. I wouldn't not have lasted if it hadn't. I mean, it was hard. It was a really hard job, and you know, stepping on people's feet that didn't like it. And he was a great support and was a great leader. And I was at the table with him when he bargained contracts. I learned a lot from him. I obviously have tremendous love for Larry, who I was very, very, very close with for, you know, 40 years. But I want it said, Chris was a great vice president. And he's a great friend, and he meant a lot to me.
Excellent. Hannah and Jeff, either of you want to ask some questions?
I'm trying to think of how to phrase this because I don't want to end this up on a down note, but you mentioned some internal conflict with the locals at one point. And you maybe if you could talk about how you managed your way through that and what pitfalls you would advise others to try and look out for and avoid if possible. I mean, was it all just personality driven or what was at play?
Well, I would say in the 1990s and really until I was the area director, not until I was the area director, but in the 1990s in particular, you know, there was a lot of tension between the locals and there was a lot of disagreement about what level of militancy there would be, what kind of mobilization there would be, what capacity there would be. There was tension and stress. And I think that the leadership that came from the area office after Larry wasn't equipped for it. And then there was tension at District 1, right? Because Jan Pierce and you have Larry Mancino come in and Lisa, you know, there's stuff that happens in unions, Lisa Reardon, and there is that tension that takes place. And some of those political tensions end up dividing the locals, right? Some of which happened recently and is still happening. There's a little bit of this right now where, you know, you had the Jan Pierce, Lisa Reardon side versus the Larry Mancino side, and that plays into other things. So there's that. When I became the area director, this was a very big change. And area directors that were there for a long time were no longer there. And people who thought they might become area directors didn't become area directors. And you bring in somebody from a local. And so there was staff tension. And then there were locals that, you know, I think that got used, right? It got used. So there were locals that weren't as supportive of me. I concentrated really hard on building a really strong relationship with the staff and changing the culture in the office, which was terrible, I thought, and really working very hard in protecting staff from ugliness coming from locals, which if you were going to ask me a disappointment, there is a culture in CWA that allows people to be abusive to each other. And a lot staff locals, we have to change it. I mean, it needs work. It needs work. And I worked very hard at the staff level and, you know, really developed great relationships with staff and built that. And then we worked it at the local level. And some people didn't like me. And I came to the conclusion that that was okay too. I could be respectful of their position. They weren't always as respectful. I mean, I think there is some nastiness that I don't like in the way people talk to each other and do things, and it's tolerated and shouldn't be. But I could be respectful of their position within the union and accept the fact that they didn't like me, and I didn't even have to like them. I could just respect their position, and that's what I would do. And I did overcome it, but it was hard and it was painful.
That's very helpful. I think sometimes we also don't have mentoring systems that help people, both local leaders and staff, because it's such hard work, both interpersonally and the actual making tough decisions.
You know, and I think also we have to be very direct with management, and we don't. Part of what we're doing is not considering their personal feelings. We are doing something else. We are representing workers. And so we can be very direct and sometimes harsh. And then that turns into it at the union with everybody, sort of just can be very harsh with each other. And there are power struggles that take place. And then they, you know, they show themselves in highly personal ways that we need to work on. We need to work on it. We'll take it or don't take it, but what took place in terms of that election and the fact of what came to be known is a part of this. The idea that goes on, and it doesn't just go on at a staff level. I mean, I have been the recipient and seen staff be the recipient of grotesque behavior by locals. Yeah. And it's, you know, we do wonderful and great and amazing things. I don't want to take away from it. We could learn a few things. We could stop doing some things.
Yeah. Hannah, any questions?
I have a few questions, but my first immediately is there a process for reporting abuse or harassment within the youth?
There is, and at the last convention, I think they passed something else. I don't think the problem is reporting.
Okay. Well, okay, so I have a couple questions I want to ask. The first one is that you are the first person we've talked to that mentioned promoting LGBTQ plus rights and safety as part of your work in the union. So I'm wondering, why was that important to you? And what was the work you did to try to change the culture in CWA?
I mean, we did something incredible. I think it's 1986. It could have been 80, as early as 83. There was there's a non-discrimination paragraph in the CWA contract, and we included in that contract, I don't remember what the words were, whether it was gender preference or, you know, whatever the terms were at that point. But we included in that contract that in the same discrimination article that spoke about race and sex and disabilities and religion, we included sexual preference. So I think that was an incredible thing, right? And important. And, you know, I don't know how any other places that had it. So we were, you know, we were the vanguard at that point.
Did it come out of the membership?
I actually think it came from John Kelly in 1033. I mean, I think there was a person who was on the bargaining committee who, you know, was, you know, who said it. And so then we did it. So, I mean, I don't know. I could be wrong about that, but it came from the bargaining committee. I mean, it was bargained. I don't know exactly how it happened, but it was. And then because we were in civil service, this is in the 80s, in 1037, or maybe it might have been later, might have been the 90s, the early 90s. In 1037, we had a trans member who wasn't being given a promotion and who scored at the top of the civil service list and was a vet. So they couldn't bypass her. And we made them give her the promotion. So this was like a remarkable, I mean, I won't say that I understood anything there, except for she came and looked and said, they got to give you the promotion. And we had civil service, so she got the promotion. And then there was a fight for marriage equality in New Jersey. It was one of the first states in New Jersey. We took it to the state Supreme Court and we attempted to get a marriage equality bill. And
we was the union or the New Jersey Citizen
Action? Well, it was Garden State Equality, which was founded by Stephen Goldstein. And I was still at Local 1037. It was probably, you know, 2002. I think I was just a new president then. And I get a call from this guy, Stephen Goldstein, and he said, we have this movement for marriage equality and we don't have labor support. And I said, okay, well, I'll do it. You know, let's do it. And we arranged for this event, this labor event. I mean, I can't tell you what the AFL-CIO thought. We were crazy, but we did this labor event and basically I invited all the shop stewards to come because I was going to be a speaker at there and we were going to do this. And we invited all the shop stewards to come. And of course we got a lot of LGBT stewards and we had other people come, but we had all our LGBT stewards come. And so that was really incredible. And we were the first union to say we were supporting marriage equality. And then we went and did lobbying with Garden State Equality. I did it with Michelle Liebtech from Local 1036. And we went and we met with different legislators where we talked about we have many members and they should be allowed to be married. And we went to demonstrate, you know, so that we did a lot of things like that. Yeah.
My other question was, it's just such a fun story that you in high school did this pants strike and you're
My
part of the
sister.
like the nascent feminist movement. Through all your years in the union, how did you see the culture, how did you see feminism impact the culture at CWA and advancing women's rights in the workplace?
I think it's been a struggle. I mean, I think it's been a struggle, and we're not far enough along. I mean, we've had strong women leaders and women leaders in high positions and as president of the locals. But this is my example. I would hate, we would go to convention and there would be this report from the women's committee. And, you know, it would be about tampons in prisons or something, you know. Not that that isn't important, but it was like, really? Vicki Thurston, who was the executive vice president of Local 1037, she'd say, "Oh, here comes the vagina monologues." It was like, it was performative. So there were things like that to me still indicated we have a long way to go. This is what, you know, the Women's Committee, and we're going to put them up here, some women. So I don't know. The silos in the union help to cause this. We have silos in the union that in part have to do with, you know, where strategic industry funds go and things like that. But sectors. But some of that has helped to, you know, continue to have power held in traditional white male telecom hands.
Last question. This has been great. This is a record of looking at the past so you can inform people in the future. So, would you like to make some final remarks of what you've learned from your life that you would like to be some guiding principles or thoughts for people in the future who want to build the union movement, feminism, economic justice, LGBTQ movements for equity and democracy?
I mean, I think first, you know, to do any of these things, you have to have courage. You have to be able to buck whatever it happens to be, whether or not it's your employer, it's your union, it's the, you know, whatever power there is, you're going to have courage. And the only way you have courage is if you have convictions. So you got to really dig deep on what you believe in and then stick with it, because the minute you move off of it, you will find yourself afraid. I mean, I've had that example that happened to me where I'm doing something that I don't completely feel comfortable with, but I have feel like I've had to make some concession in terms of my own conscience. And as soon as that happens, I'm suddenly afraid and I'm nervous. But when I'm back in a place where I know that this is the right thing to do to build power for working people and I am together with them, well, then I feel courageous. And so I think to do these things, you're going to have courage and be prepared to kind of live that. I wish that I had been kinder when I was younger. I mean, maybe that doesn't happen until you're older. I don't know. Or maybe it was me, just a flaw in me. I wish I had been kinder to people when I was younger and that it didn't take me quite so long to be nicer. And part of that, I think, also comes out of insecurity and being afraid other people won't like you or whatever it is you're doing. But I guess I would like to say that to people, that you don't have, you know, you could be kinder as an individual and still be very strong and powerful in your convictions of the things that you do. And then I just, you know, think we should try to remember that we do look through a single lens in when we're inside the union. Lots of things that I understand now, I didn't understand until I stepped away a little bit. I don't think I had the full appreciation of what our allies do and the kind of incredible political and community work that people do with no money, no dues coming in, no, you know, scrambling. And so I think that it was good to be able to step away and to see that. And I guess those are the things I would say. The other thing is I do feel like having the identity of New Jersey really helped us because, you know, people from New Jersey are very conscious of being New Jersey with its grit and all that it is. And I think it helped us and I'm proud of it.
I'm ready to end there. Do you have anything you want to add, Jeff?
No, I want to thank Hannah. You so much for doing this.
Hattie, thank you. This has been fabulous.
Debbie and I take turns doing these interviews, and I'm so glad I was in listen mode today because this has been a delight. Hattie, this was really wonderful. Thanks for doing this.
I miss you guys.
Oh, we miss you. Hattie, I will never forget when Larry brought you down to teach the staff what it is to do steward training. Those of us who didn't come out of the ranks, and it was one of the best days of my time in CWA.